Namaste, everyone. Hello. Afternoon. Good lunch. Okay. Yes.
It's Jane here.
Hi, Jane.
Would you like me to show the picture?
Oh, this is very important. This is it. Please, let's have the perfect yogic posture for everyone.
Okay, let's see if I can do it.
Yeah.
Is it there?
Not for me.
Oh, shoot. Oh, darn. I'm such a... Okay, try it again. Try one more time. I thought I had this worked out.
We have 5 more days.
Yeah, okay. That's good to know. still not there. It worked before, but it's not working yet. Okay, I'll try it later again.
Yeah, it's very important.
It's opening for me, but then when I go to share a screen, it's... Yeah. Oh, wait, I know what I have to do. One more button.
One more. That's it. Yeah. So this is the perfect posture, everyone. We call it the seal posture. So if you get in your hot tub and do that, but remember, the importance of the posture is keep your nose above the water. All right, there you go. Thank you, Jane. That's a significant contribution. Well, there you go. Better, yeah. Okay. So we're trying to catch up on the seal. I once went, me and 2 other people, we went to, my mother went, before she died, I said, what should I do with your ashes? And she said, take them to the Atlantic and scatter them in the Atlantic so that they might drift back to Latvia, which was very poignant. You can see how being a refugee, how one sort of never gets over that. And so I went out with 2 people. 3 of us went out to off the coast of... Nova Scotia, where that, you know, the Tibetan nun that has the place up there? Pema Chodron, is it? And not by plan, but by some coincidence, we ended up starting at the base of her monastery. So there, Adrian was the, she knew how to do coastal kayaking, so we had 3 kayaks. And Ken was South Africa, he's a doctor from Hamilton. So we all went on this trip, and I had mom's ashes, and Adrian had her dog's ashes, and Ken, I said, this is what we're going to do, Ken, and he got, and his dad had died 2 years ago, so he had his dad's shaving brush. So then, and I'd never been kayaking in open water on the Atlantic. I'd been kayaking in lakes and rivers, mostly canoeing, really. So we went out, and I think on, and we were camping. We spent 5 days, and we were camping on the rocks. One day we set up our tents too close to the shore. In the middle of the night, we had to scurry up the banks because the tide was coming in. We almost lost it. But on the second day, it was a very, very beautiful and calm day. So we went out, and I started to do the chanting, and I took part of mom's ashes, part of it I also brought to Latvia and scattered them off the Baltic coast. You can do a lot with ashes, by the way. So I started to do the chanting, and I had a bag, and I emptied out the bag as I was chanting into the Atlantic. And then Adrian had the dog's ashes. I think it was a husky. I can't remember. And she scattered them. And then Ken had tied a rock to his dad's shaving brush. And It was very emotional. We were all crying there. And so he pops that into the ocean, gurgles down. So then we started to paddle along the coast. We had about a maybe 4-hour paddle. It was just beautiful. You see the little pilot whales and so on. And on as we were going down the coast, there was a herd of seals, maybe 100. And as soon as they saw us coming, they came off the shore, and a lot of the youngsters came and sort of played with us, just like young teenagers coming up and looking at us and ooh, and then disappearing. It's, oh, so sweet. But on the shore, there was one seal that didn't come down. And we watched, and we went by, realized, ah, that's a dead one. And it was so, again, poignant. You have, mom's died, there's all this life and beautiful animal life, and then there's the dead one, too. There's something very, very, very moving about that. And then as we went down, the swells from the ocean were coming in and getting bigger. And I had a really neat canoe. You could kind of surf with it, kayak. You could kind of surf with it. But Adrian was getting a bit anxious because she kind of understood the water. I didn't really understand what's going on. I was just having fun. And she was getting nervous that we should get into shore. So we eventually, I can't remember the little harbor, but the swells were really taking us into shore, and then finally we reached the mouth of the harbor, and the harbor was protected. And we went through these kind of concrete walls which was the mouth of the harbor, and outside the walls, the swells were getting bigger. And then we were kind of just shoved into this harbor and in a beautiful kind of surfing motion. And then all of a sudden in the harbor, it was still. It was just this beautiful, beautiful stillness. And that's one of the descriptions of Nibbana, the harbor. Sometimes we say refuge, the harbor. And maybe to Dave's question about, so what is this enlightenment stuff tastes like? And I said, chocolate. But it is that stillness. I was thinking, what could you say about that? Because any words are always dualistic. It's like, it's happy, then it's not sad. You kind of get into the dualism of experience. So this isn't so much an experience that you try to find, but it's something that you notice that's there all the time. Otherwise, it would not be transcendent. It would still be contingent. So this cannot be contingent on experience or circumstance. And that's why it's always, when we talk about the Dhamma, it's always here and now, not a matter of time. We do that kind of chanting. Not something that you search for. It's something you realize is. Language is difficult. So, but those, that's why the language is around like imagery. So the harbor for me, it was just such an insight. Yeah, that's why they say harbor. It was so safe. It was refuge, right? And the contrast from the increasingly frightening waves that were coming in, it was nothing really, it was compared to what the Atlantic can do, but you felt the power of that body of water. You don't want to be out there unless you're a whale. But in here, and so the image of sensory experience is that it's dangerous. Now, it's also fun. The swells of the water are fun and so on. But the idea is that the danger is that it's born and dying, born and dying, born and dying. And then you have the stillness, which isn't born and dying. And the closest I think we can approximate that, not approximate, maybe notice something, is when I ask you, listen to sound, and then savor the stillness of knowing. Because the knowing is still, isn't it? Then the thought starts up, right? And the thought is usually habitual or based on trying to get something or get rid of something. And that's why we're a bit down on all of that. Huh? So it's not a question of sense experience being bad. It's just that you won't find the stillness in the movement, let's say. But in the movement, you can notice stillness, if you see what I mean. So I'm saying, listen to sound, right? But also notice the stillness. Well, usually if we're, like if I'm interested in a piece of music or a oratory, like I like to listen to oratory because I do a bit of talking. So I enjoy Mr. Obama's speeches, just listening to him and Dr. King and so on. So then I'm listening to the object and I'm concerned about the object, its beauty or whatever it's done, which is fine. But then I can also do something else. I can listen to change and not be concerned about the quality of the object, but notice the stillness of knowing. See? So then if you take that to your meditation, the quality of your meditation is going to change. Every meditation, even during the meditation, sometimes it'll feel restless and sometimes it'll feel whatever. But if you're interested in the harbor rather than in the qualities, then you kind of understand the project. So then like Vasa's question about restlessness, okay, that those are the waves, but where is the harbor in the waves? And that's the stillness of knowing. Those are, for me, they're very, very good images. So the last meditation, that's what I was kind of encouraging. Listen to sound, savor the stillness of knowing. Feel your body, savor the stillness of knowing. And then if you can do that in complex situations, if you're in a family situation and there's maybe like I've heard that a lot of parents who are older now are living with their kids who are 20 or 25 and the music tastes I heard are different. So I've heard rumors that someone of maybe 60-ish years old might have a daughter who likes rap or whatever the music is nowadays. And you know, that to me would be quite disturbing, all that kind of boom, boom, boom kind of stuff. And yet there you are. There you are in that situation. And it's not bad. But if you think, okay, in this boom, boom, boom sound, is there stillness? And if you can come to that sense of oh, it's like this, you start to notice the stillness within the movement. It's more difficult there because it's so disturbing. Then take like a difficult emotion, then it's even more difficult, right? A more contracted thing. So my suggestion then is the more you can bypass the intellectual processes, the analysis, because we get, that's very kind of, we're well trained in analysis, but sometimes we take that as the last resort, and it doesn't work. You know, we're so trained in analyzing problems, and we think there's a problem, and then we try to figure it out with thought, but we're just in the same realm all the time. Whereas if you can just feel something strong in yourself through the body, through the heart, you bypass that judgmental, all that stuff, and you're directly with it. Because thought is not anger. Thought mediates anger as storyline, as narrative, as analysis. But anger itself, say, is different. It's not a thought. You know, it's visceral, it's in the body. And the more you can get directly in contact with that, I think the more that you understand. And you understand in a way which isn't analytical. You understand that this is something that has arisen, has endured, and has passed away. That's right understanding, yeah? Which is the same right understanding all the time, all the time. So each time you have a more strong experience of something and you enter into that witnessing, you understand. You understand it's like this, that it's changing. Rather than right understanding being some great experience that, you know, blows your head off and then you understand the rest of your life, that kind of like an acid trip or something like that. It's different. It's not extreme in that way, right? It's more like, awareness is actually, it's so ordinary. it's so terribly ordinary, you think, well, that can't be it. You know, it has to be more than that. And so then we often don't trust in awareness of change because it seems so, oh, big deal. And we want something, and the desire mind then seeks something. But the only thing that desire can find is another contingent object. So you think about that, like the harbor. It's a really neat experience. So let's do some meditation. I'd like to maybe, you know, like set it up with that idea of that things are moving in awareness, trying to get that idea. And again, emphasize the heart. And I think the end of the out-breath is very interesting, just as a place to stay in the present moment, not concentrate so much, just to stay in the present moment and see what happens at the end of the out-breath as a kind of inquiry. So let's do that. And we'll sit for 45 minutes again. Oh, I was, just to remind everyone, we did, Venerable Vipassi got the last sessions up on the website again. So every day at 12 o'clock, that'll come up as an update of the previous sessions that we've had. So thank you, sir, over the computer. Okay, let's do some meditation then. So you want to have a kind of very easy way to enter or remember the present moment. It's not like you're not here, but just to that sense of remembering, knowing. Know that you know, as I like to say. So yeah, I use sound. And the idea is like a receptive knowing, isn't it? So observe in yourself, are you trying to notice a particular sound? Or you're just letting sound be what it is. And then if you're not trying to find a sound, you're just allowing sound to be, you're grounding yourself in the present moment, as it were. But you also notice the stillness of knowing. So like here, through the window, I can hear the wind blowing through the trees, it's raining every now and then. That's the change. And the knowing, the stillness of knowing. And then, of course, that's hard to sustain that because we go off into thought. So this is what you're trying to return to as you meditate. Whatever you're meditating on, return to that still knowing. But sometimes the attitude is one of very control or holding or trying to get something. So the suggestion of coming to the heart, I use a lot. So when you do that, bring attention to the center of the chest. Now don't tighten up your eyes or tighten up your hands. It's not you trying to get anything, you're just localizing attention. And you can feel the body, and there's the stillness of knowing. It's always there. And then the attitude of kindness is that I find crucial or very helpful. And bringing in an image of someone dear to you on the in-breath, connect to that tone of mind which is grateful or affectionate or appreciative when you think of that person or imagine them. So the in-breath that reminds you of that. Out-breath, you can say something, may you be well, or thank you. And, you know, in meditation, there's kind of no rush to get anywhere. There isn't that kind of urgency to achieve anything, all of that which we have in our makeup. I guess good enough, one breath at a time. So having remembered that attitude, and feel the whole breath, which we sometimes call the breath body, breathing from the beginning to the end, from the end to the beginning. And there's the stillness of knowing for one in-breath, an out-breath. And you've got all the time in the world. So that might be quite sufficient, but you could localize attention more. So an interesting place to observe your experiences through the end of the out-breath. So you make a note of that. What's the end of the out-breath? What happens there? There's still the stillness of knowing and whole body awareness. Maybe you notice that on the in-breath you tense your hands or your face, or your mind wanders at the end of the out-breath. So by choosing this sort of window, then you heighten the capacity to sustain awareness moment by moment. But you're not trying to get anything. It's just a training in still knowing for spans of time. All right, let's be quiet and give that a go. See, experiment with your own breath. So, if you have the opportunity to keep doing formal practice, please do so. If you like to sit, keep sitting, change postures so you extend this period of formal practice for another hour if you can, or 2 hours. This is a very, can be very interesting. It's not just a matter of willfully sitting many hours. I think young monks do that. They kind of clock in as many hours as they can. And Ajahn Chah used to say, well, the water buffaloes stay still out there for 8 hours. So big deal, right? So it's not a matter of clocking in the hours. It's a matter that I think the quality of curiosity and investigation, what happens in a longer period of non-distraction when you are using a meditation object or inquiring about the body or whatever it is. And so it's like a laboratory, isn't it? The parameters are very controlled and contained, and you can observe what happens when you live in a way of non-distraction for 2 or 3 hours. So it's a very special opportunity. In any case, I shall be back at 7 Ottawa time. So bon chance, and we shall see you later.